Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 16th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is Barbara Rossing. Today's session is number 99.9 and is titled Ecology and the Bible, God's Voice from the Whirlwind, Ecology in the Book of Job. Let's listen in.
I'm Barbara Rossing from Chicago, the Lutheran School of Theology, and this is the final part in a little series on the Bible and ecology, just sort of taking soundings, looking at different books of the Bible, different strands of biblical perspectives. From the beginning, we've been operating with this premise that there are different voices in the Bible, sometimes competing voices. On Tuesday, Jim Martin Tram showed you how, in a sense, the two accounts of creation in Genesis 1 and 2 are kind of competing. The one in Genesis 1 is a more ordered and hierarchical view. The thesis, at least, of Ted Hebert is that the second one in Genesis 2 is a more sort of humble and farmer-oriented perspective on creation, that the human is formed from the humus, or that the farmer is formed from farmland and tills it, and that's the earliest biblical vocation we see is the importance of the agricultural perspective. Yesterday, we looked at some of the injustices that happened in the Old Testament as far as shifts in the political economy that I think are maybe reflected in the prophet Hosea and some of the devastation of the land that's threatened there, and then also in the book of Revelation. And obviously, I was giving you a very peculiar reading of the book of Revelation, arguing that some of the deforestation and overuse of the land that happened under the Roman imperial domination in the first century that Revelation cries out against is useful for us today as we seek an ecological perspective, and that coming out of Babylon might mean rejecting that kind of political economy of merchants and mariners and rulers dominating, where you have to have money to buy and sell, where those cargo ships are going back and forth with all the logs, with all the ivory, with all the other goods that were traded in Roman times that we see in Revelation 18, 12, and 13, and that the vision of God's New Jerusalem is an alternative city, an alternative kingdom that we are citizens of, that calls us to even now live in terms of that vision. A perspective on God's holy city where there is not buying and selling, where abundant life, the essentials of life and health, the water of life are given without cost, without money, even to those who can't afford to buy them. But I didn't leave very much time for discussion, so I guess I just want to start with a little kind of question to all of you about the whole idea of using apocalyptic literature, which is what the book of Revelation is, using this to try to do ecology. Because I think there are both pluses and minuses to it. It's interesting to me, I hadn't realized this until I finally finished reading Ted Hebert's book up here, which I had never finished. And I don't know if he would say the same thing now that, this is my own hubris here, now that the two of us have taught together, and I've tried to persuade him that there's more to apocalyptic literature than meets the eye. But it does, apocalyptic literature, you know, I mean, you know about apocalyptic movies, these sort of world destruction scenarios, you know, and various. I just got a birthday card from a friend of mine who says, it had a picture of a sort of mushroom cloud, and then it said, "This is your last birthday of this millennium. Have a blast." you know, and it's sort of this, it's the apocalyptic worldview that does have these sort of stark contrasts between good and evil, between light and darkness, you know, that uses nature in a very vivid way to both speak of God's judgment and God's salvation. Certainly in the book of Revelation, animals and plants are much more active and waters than in other books of the Bible. So Ted Hebert, let me just read a little bit here, because this is kind of a typical perspective of thoughtful, ecologically minded theologians. Basically, I'll summarize it. The perspective is that apocalyptic literature is bad news for ecology. He says, almost in their entirety, the Hebrew scriptures share the Yahwist's unitary perspective. That is the idea that the farmer is formed from the farmland, that we're meant to be part of the earth, to till the earth, kind of be a servant of the earth, and it's this unitary perspective. Only with the rise of apocalyptic thought, late in Israelite history, is this unified conception of reality broken. The apocalyptic worldview despaired of life in this world and conceived of human salvation only through a complete transformation of world's order as a new existence. And he says for that reason that apocalyptic thought is scary, because it gives you the idea there's another world, you know, and in its most extreme form, it can lead to the kind of mentality of former Secretary of the Interior James Watt. I think he was Secretary of the Interior under Ronald Reagan. And at his Senate confirmation hearings, he alluded to this. He's a conservative fundamentalist Christian. And then he gave some other speeches to evangelical audiences where he was even more explicit. Basically, this world isn't all there is. Since the Lord is returning soon anyway, we might as well use up all the trees before the Lord returns. And that's the sort of extreme, one of the possible logical consequences of an apocalyptic perspective. That's.
I don't think you could blame that on the apocalyptic literature.
Okay, good. No, I don't either. Another author whose book I think is in the bookstore. Again, we didn't order this one because it costs $50 hardback. We've got to all pressure Ted to get it out in paperback. But a book called Gaia and God by Rosemary Ruther, which I really like. She's a theologian. Her chapter on apocalyptic literature is called Religious Narratives of World Destruction. And she basically says the same thing, that apocalyptic literature overall is about the destruction of the world. It's this kind of dualistic perspective, and it's very problematic for an ecological perspective. Now, I'm arguing differently, of course, but I just thought I'd throw that out to you and ask, you know, and then you also hear environmentalists sometimes talking about environmental apocalypse. And I think it's a question to what degree and in what circumstances these kinds of categories are helpful. Do you want to speak about the environmental degradation that we're experiencing right now? Is this an apocalypse? Do you want to talk about it in those kinds of sort of catastrophic categories? Is that helpful or not? What are the pluses and minuses of using this kind of literature and talking in that kind of language that's more apocalyptic in character? Any thoughts on that one? Is global warming apocalyptic?
No.
No?
No. Well, it's a matter of the kingdom on the left. It's something we've done to ourselves.
But some of the things that happen in apocalypses can be that, too. But, I mean, I tend to agree with you. I don't find it that helpful. I mean, I'm hesitant, I guess, to speak so catastrophically about stuff. But I don't know. Somebody had a hand up over here. Uh-huh.
I think I agree with her that it removes human responsibility for what is happening to creation. And I don't mean to say or to suggest that the world is going to remain as it was in the beginning. You know, I think it's in a constant state of evolution. But whatever we do to it, to affect that evolution can be very harmful. I mean, we need to discern which of our actions are necessary and which could be limited.
Mm-hmm. And apocalyptic literature doesn't tend to give that sense of responsibility.
It removes the responsibility.
Uh-huh. Now, I'll disagree with that somewhat, too, when I do stuff in the Book of Revelation, but I realize I'm against the grain here. I mean, I think I follow the perspective of those who think the apocalypse is much of the language that sounds predictive about world destruction is actually exhortation. It's calling us to participation so that this scenario won't happen. But that's a kind of a minority view. You had a...
Yeah, well, what we read the other day in Revelation 18 about the merchants won't be able to sell their goods, and that I think it kind of addresses priorities and material accumulation which affects the environment in the long run, you know, using just consumerism versus thinking about, what we use.
Yeah, and that's taking kind of literal reading of that cargo list that I was suggesting we could try out as an ecological way. Thanks. Dan?
I was just thinking, Barbara, Wes Howard Brook, who was here for teaching Bible study earlier this summer and also focused on the Book of Revelation, seemed to agree largely with what you're saying in that he argues that apocalypse literally means unveiling. It unveils, so we see the world really the way it really is, rather than, as he would argue, through the eyes of empire, through the eyes of Rome. And thinking, so that same thing when you were talking about in Revelation 18 about the costs of the empire, whether it's in human slaves or whether it's in big degraded forces and stuff, what Apocalypse does is not so much predict the future, but take the blinders away from our eyes about the way the world is now, and then reducing its exhortation to live unblinded, to live unveiled in this world. And from that perspective, I think it can really be ecologically as well as socially important for us to see unveiled.
Thanks. Yeah, I wish I could do more on Revelation with you this week, but the image I sometimes use is from the movie The Wizard of Oz, where Dorothy and her companions finally get to Oz, and they're so kind of terrified by Oz, and he's great and terrible, and he's telling them things. And it's Toto who plays the role, I think, of the apocalyptic seer who goes and pulls back the curtain and sort of unveils what Oz really is, which is just a little man from Kansas pulling levers. I mean, we do need that sense of unveiling. The catastrophic imagery, however, I mean, that's sort of the question. Now, I will say, and what an area that we didn't even get into this week at all, and I apologize, is sort of global thinking. One book I really like is called Eco-Theology, Voices from South and North, where there are essays by people from the Philippines, from Africa, from Latin America, especially one by Boff here, Leonardo Boff. And you realize that in a lot of places, the environmental degradation, in Philippines, for example, where it used to be almost totally forested and now 90% of the forest has been cut down just in one generation. I mean, this is sort of apocalyptic in its dimensions, the changes that we're causing to the environment. I mean, so that people from the third world, interestingly, do tend in here to evoke those kinds of categories to speak of catastrophe, not just change. Keep that issue in mind as we shift today into a whole other kind of biblical literature. Couldn't be more different, and that is biblical wisdom literature. I mean, there are overlaps. I think they draw on each other for some of the imagery and for some of the forms that they use. For example, both apocalyptic and wisdom literature use the form of beatitudes or blessings. They'll often say, blessed is the person who such and such. So there are overlaps, but it's a different type of biblical literature entirely. Wisdom literature is more about human wisdom, more about people's observations. Several of the wisdom books are quite optimistic in outlook, the book of Proverbs in a way, the Psalms, a number of the Psalms are wisdom Psalms. There are two wisdom books that are kind of pessimistic in outlook. Those are typically categorized as the book of Ecclesiastes or Qohelet, and then the book of Job. A couple other wisdom books we're not even going to have time to look at are apocryphal books, but wonderful nonetheless. So if you have a Bible that has the Apocrypha, take a look at the Wisdom of Solomon sometime, or the Book of Sirach, which is, especially Sirach 24 is a wonderful chapter about a personified figure of wisdom, a feminine figure of wisdom. We looked yesterday at the feminine images. Because wisdom is a feminine noun in Hebrew, chokmah, when wisdom is personified, it's personified as a woman. So this is an incredible personified chapter in Sirach 24 about how wisdom is living up in heaven with God. She's God's right-hand person, And God sends her down to earth to find a dwelling on earth. She does come to dwell in Judah and Israel. And then it's this beautiful nature text about all the rivers that flow there in the land. God's law is like a river. It's all about the river of life and the trees of life, really. It's a wonderful tree passage. If you need another reference for Holden's theme this summer, the tree of life, look at Sirach 24. It's a gorgeous chapter about the outpouring of wisdom and flourishing in our lives as being like a tree. But Job is a different type of book. And that's what I want to take a look at today. Now, most of you know the story of Job, right? Who'd be willing to summarize the first 37 chapters? Just the basic outline of the story. What happens at the beginning? God and Satan have a little conversation, right? And what happens? Yeah, God brags about Job. Have you ever seen my servant Job? He's such a great guy. You know, he's a marvelous example of uprightness and everything. And Satan says what?
Because you're blessed.
Yeah, it's just because he's rich. He has everything. Of course, he's a wonderful, upright guy. Let's see what happens if you take everything away and see if he's still then a faithful servant of God. And so what happens? Everything happens to Job. He loses his money first, his wealth, right? All his lands and property. He gets sick. What about his family? They die. Yeah, and his wife, I mean, she's got questions about him too, right? And all his friends turn against him, right? And the first 37 chapters are basically these speeches, this back and forth between Job and his friends, where his friends basically say, this wouldn't have happened to you except that you must have done something bad, because we know that bad things happen to bad people. And you know, just accept the fact that you're guilty and be willing to accept that. And Job insists on his innocence. It's a really interesting story. Now, there's all kinds of angles from which the book of Job can be viewed. I mean, much, much literature on Job. It's a magnificent book of the Old Testament. I mean, certainly the issue of theodicy is what we call it, you know, how to deal with the problem of evil. That's obviously the central issue of this book. Some of you might have seen or even starred in the whole, at least at Holden, you can star in any play. The play J.B., by Archibald MacLeish, is that who wrote that? Yeah. A play on the book of Job. Anybody seen that one or been in it? You've read it? Okay. Have you been on the Holden stage in that play? No? Okay, we've got copies of it here. Some recent political author has written a book on Job, and I can't remember who it is, if it's William Bennett or who, or Harold Bloom, somebody. Anyway, it gets written about a lot. There's a book by who is it?
Something like Staffshire.
Shaffire. It's William Shaffire. Is right. That right? Is that his name?
I've read it.
Sapphire. Okay. Gustavo Gutierrez, a really important Latin American theologian, has a wonderful book on Job from a liberation perspective. I mean, until I saw that in the Holden story a few years ago, I had no idea you could do a liberation take on Job, but he does a really fine job of that. A guy named Rene Girard has a book on Job from this whole sort of scapegoat perspective that he's developed in a question of redemptive violence. I mean, there's lots being written about Job, and you can look at it from many, many angles. What I want to look at it from today, though, is an ecological angle. I'll just float this one by you. Maybe you've never thought of it before. I hadn't. But this is a little book by a nature writer named Bill McKibben. He's written other books. Let's see. What are they called?
The Death of Nature.
The Death of Nature? Is that him?
End of Nature.
Yeah, The End of Nature. The Age of Missing Information, it says. He's had articles published in The New Yorker, New York Times, Rolling Stone. interesting combination there. An active environmentalist and an active United Methodist Church member. He's a lay preacher in his church and very much a Christian in this book. It's really kind of wonderful. And the book is called The Comforting Whirlwind, God, Job, and the Scale of Creation. I only ordered it for the bookstore last week, so I apologize that it's not in yet. But if you can find it, get it soon, because I think it might soon go out of print. It's 1994, and you know how fast books go out of print. But it's under $10. It's a great little book here. Very, very readable. Beautiful. And so I just kind of want to lay out today with you his thesis. But first, let's read a little bit from the book of Job, starting with chapter 38. Okay, so we've covered the first 37 chapters, right? thoroughly covered the first 37 chapters. And he's got his friends, what is it, Elihu and Bildad, is that, who are these? Anyway, they've been talking to him. And Job has been pleading with God, answer me, why is this happening to me? I don't accept any of these guys' as answers, but something's going on. What's the deal? And the friends keep saying, this is God's justice. We know that God is just. You must have done something. And Job doesn't believe it for a minute. Finally, though, in chapter 38, God answers Job out of the whirlwind. Let's read verses... Well, it's so beautiful. We can't read the whole thing. Let's read 1 through 11. And you can, and if somebody who wants, just read as far as you want, and then you can stop, and then the next person can read. Read loudly so we can all hear.
Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird your up your loins like a man. I will question you when you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed bounds for it, and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come and no further, and there shall, and here shall your proud wage be stayed. Let's see that.
Thank you. Let's see, let's read 22 to 27 as well. Somebody else want to volunteer for that?
Have you entered the storehouses of the snow, or have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of trouble, for the day of battle and war? What is the way to the place where the light is distributed, or where the east wind is scattered upon the earth? Who has cut a channel for the torrents of rain and a way for the thunderbolt? To bring rain on land where no one lives, on a desert which is empty of human life, to satisfy the waste and desolate land, and to make the ground put forth grass.
Okay. I wish we could read the whole thing. It's so beautiful. I mean, then he goes on to say in verse 31, you know, can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? He even talks about the constellations, how God set those up there. Orion, you know, beautiful Orion, who, if you've ever been here in the winter, Orion jumps from Buckskin over to Copper Mountain every night. He puts on a show. I mean, the stars. And God is basically saying, you know, can you do this? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? All right, so what do you get from this speech? Why? What is God doing in this speech? Why is God answering Job this way? What do you notice about it?
To give him a sense of awe.
Awe.
And wonder.
Awe and wonder. Others?
Who are you? Who are you to question anything is the way I feel about it. It's only the Lord has the answers.
Uh-huh.
And we should believe him.
And Job has been thinking of himself as somewhat larger than his actual place. Others, what do you think?
He's declaring himself as the creator of all.
Yeah. God is saying, I'm the one who created. Uh-huh. If I say more about this sense of awe, what kind of awe? I mean, what evokes awe here?
Well, just the grandeur of everything in the creation, that it's beyond human, well, even just to look at it, to look at the mountains is something, and to try and climb while you find around here, that it really takes something to scale and climb these mountains, and so how much greater then would be the one that put them there in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it even puts in perspective being here. I mean, when yeah. you're in the mountains and the trees and you say, who am I, you know, yeah. when I see all the splendor of God, it kind of puts you in your place.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I've only seen like a little tiny rock slide that came down a gully right after I had crossed, and you realize even this little dinky rock slide would be enough to kill me. I mean, nature is big. Well, this is great. This is exactly what McKibben says is going on here. Let me just sort of back up. He says, I mean, he starts out his little book here by saying Job lived in a time of an orthodoxy that he could no longer believe in. And that was this orthodoxy, this idea that good people get good things to happen to them and bad people have bad things happen to them. And Job was sort of finding this orthodoxy didn't work anymore. McKibben's thesis is to show that we too live in the grip of conventional wisdoms and orthodoxy that no longer fit easily with the observable facts. Namely, he calls this conventional wisdom or our orthodoxy more. This is what he says is the prevailing theology of our culture and our time, and he puts a capital M on more because he says we've made basically a god out of this idea of more. He says, though, that this orthodoxy doesn't work. But here's how he says how much it dominates us. And, of course, he's being provocative here, but he says, Dan Rather wouldn't dream of coming on the air and saying, we've got some good news tonight. The Democrats are surging ahead of the Republicans. That would be partisan. That would be taking sides. It wouldn't be objective. But increased wealth, more, is such a given for us that it's assumed that no other side exists, that any objective viewer would naturally agree, and that only a crank would think otherwise. I mean, you can't even turn on National Public Radio anymore without hearing every hour on the hour what the Dow Jones Industrial Average is doing. And good is up, bad is down, unless it's just a little correction, you know, and it gives you time to buy more stuff. It goes down, But he says this is the basic orthodoxy that we hear every day, all day of our lives, and that this is so-called wisdom, this idea of more and bigger and consumption. So what he argues here is, he says, we've raised more on a pedestal. It is every bit as unchallenged as the orthodoxy and piety of Job's friends, or the mechanical earth-centered universe of Ptolemy. This is an all-encompassing doctrine that we sort of live by, according to McKibben. And he says two things about more. First of all, he argues that it can't work, it's not sustainable, and, you know, then he uses sort of the typical environmental data that we all hear a lot, you know, global warming and stuff, that it just logically, you can't continue to consume more and more and more. It can't go on forever. And then he argues, secondly, that it doesn't make us happy. That even though advertising is designed now to tie in all of your insecurities and desires with products that you can buy to satiate your needs and desires and wants, that in fact, most of us are still as hollow as anyone in Job's time was. I mean, it's not making us any happier. So his two sorts of theses about this theology of more are it can't be sustained, it's not workable for the whole world, and two, it's not making us happy. And he does, interestingly, he does have a kind of a global consciousness in here about poverty. I mean, it can't work for everybody in the world, therefore it can't be justifiable for some of us few, for whom it still is working a little longer, is his argument. So he says, basically, Job was struggling with the orthodoxy of his day, with the so-called obvious notion that God dispenses prosperity to the good and punishment to the wicked. So too, we, late 20th century Westerners, are beginning to struggle with an orthodoxy of our own, the central economic and social, and I would add, and theological idea that more is better, that growth is necessary. He says both of these orthodoxies stem from the same assumption, that is, that human beings are and should be at the center of the universe. And he argues that what the book of Job does is precisely what you all have identified here. It decenters us. I mean, Job, in a sense, the first 37 chapters, they're eloquent, wonderful speeches, but they're all focused on Job. Why me? You know, they're very much focused on him and his predicament, the question of whether God is just to him. And obviously, we need to have a personal relationship with God. But McKibben is arguing that the answer that comes to Job is one of radically decentering his anthropocentric, me and human-centered vision. And it's this, as you say, the vastness and awe of creation that somehow provides an answer to Job. I'm interested in the reply that God provides to Job when God speaks from the whirlwind at the end of the book of Job. I think it is a shatteringly radical answer, one that undercuts every bit of the orthodoxies that entwine us. And he says that the answer that God gives in these chapters, and we're going to read more of them, we're going to read in chapter 39 too. I mean, it's just beautiful nature writing. It's spectacular. And it does seem in a way to satisfy Job. I mean, the answer, however different from what Job expects, I mean, it's eloquent and beautiful. McKibben says it teaches two things to Job that somehow are strangely exactly what Job needs to learn, even though it's not what he's asking for. The first thing is humility. Look back at what we already read here. Notice a couple of things. That the stuff that God is talking about in chapter 38, if you think back to the Genesis creation account, Genesis 1 now, God is referring back to things that basically happened on the first 5 days of creation, before humans were even created. I mean, that is one really interesting thing about the Genesis 1 account, is this idea that there was time before humans were created. And the stuff that God is sort of saying about creation are those early day things. You know, where, verse 4, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Well, that was back on day 3, right? Or was it day 2? Anyway, it's before humans. Tell me, if you understand, who determined its measurements? Well, humans weren't even around then, and I think God is trying to recall that to Job. Interestingly here, verse 25 through 27, who has cut a channel for the torrents of rain? God is the answer here. These are rhetorical questions. And notice 26, to bring rain on a land where no one lives, no person lives, on the desert, which is empty of human life. It's very interesting that so much of what's going on in this speech is underscoring nature's wildness. Precisely the places where humans aren't, God says, are also really an important part of this creation. So McKibben's argument is that Job is somehow answered in his own self-centered or anthropocentric perspective. He's answered with this reminder of God's care for a world even, I'll just read it here. Even more notable, however, is the setting of this speech. God is describing a world without people, a world that existed long before people and that seems to have its own independent meaning. Most of the action takes place long before the appearance of humans, and on a scale so powerful and vast that we are small indeed in the picture of things. The only reference to our species in this speech makes the point absolutely clear. That is, it's a land where no humans dwell. Rain even falls there. So we're almost sort of negative in this speech of God that is talking about the vastness of creation and the wildness of creation. So McKibben says the first thing that God teaches Job from the whirlwind is this sense of humility. Humility first and foremost. That is certainly Job's reaction. If we are not, as we currently believe, as our orthodoxy of more teaches us, if we are not at the absolute epicenter of the created world, then we need to learn to humble ourselves. And so he talks about the importance of humility in this speech. The second thing he says you learn from the speech from the whirlwind is joy. I think that's a little bit of what you were talking about, Vi, the sense of awesome, and that it's not just awesome bigness, it's awesome beauty. And that somehow this sort of startling wonder, he calls it an ebullient, shivery wildness that echoes throughout this whole passage, that this evokes in us and in Job a sense of joy and wonder and delight. See what you think of that. Let's look at some more of this speech. All right, so in chapter 38, he covers the foundation of the world, the waters here, that even rains on a land where no one dwells, the stars. Let's look at chapter 39 and see if you, as you read through this, does it evoke in you a sense of delight and joy? And if so, what is it about it? Let's read chapter 39. Oh, man, it's so beautiful. Well, let's get through the ostrich, verse 18. And just read however much you want. I mean, if you want to just do one animal, then the next person could move to the next animal. Here's all about the wild animals here.
Do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they give birth? When they crouch to give birth to their offspring and are delivered of their young. Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go forth and do not return to them.
Who has let the wild ass go free? Who has loosed the bonds of the swift ass, to which I have given the steppe for its home, the salt land for its dwelling place? It scorns the tumult of the city. It does not hear the shouts of the driver. It ranges the mountains as its pasture, and it searches after every green thing.
Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Will it spend the night at your crib? Can you tie it in the furrow with ropes, or will it harrow the valleys after you? Will you depend on it because its strength is great, and will you hand over your labor to it? Do you have faith in it that it will return and bring your grain to your threshing floor?
The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions and plumage of love? For she leaves her eggs to the earth and lets them be warmed on the ground, forgetting that a foot may crush them and that the wild beast may trample them. She deals cruelly with her young as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, yet she has no fear, because God has made her forget wisdom and given her no share in understanding. When she rouses herself to flee, she laughs at the horse and his rider.
Okay, this is a curious one. McKibben says here, the sense of ebullient, shivery wildness runs through this whole poem. The foolish ostrich, redeemed by her pure speed, her pure laughing speed. She can outrun the horse, and she laughs at it. He says, this is not the tame and citified vision of the lion lying down with the lamb. It is rapacious, tough, deadly, amoral, glorious wildness. And this wildness is a gift that gives us joy and delight. What do you think about that one? I have more trouble with this, but I want to hear from the rest of you, sir. I mean, because we know that nature also has this cruel side that's talked about with the ostrich here. Overall, is it joy? What do you feel in reading this or in nature as you observe it? I mean, you've been around hiking here, even though it's raining today. I'm sure you've been out on the trail enough to know what you feel.
Well, it's fascinating. It's, you know, overwhelming. We saw it the other night, the videotape of the bear that had been swimming in the railroad creek down here. Did anybody?
No, where do you see that video?
Jerry from the hike house was showing it.
Really? Okay.
And, you know, and this bear, it didn't just lumber into the creek. It got up on this big rock, and it looked like it put its hands up in there, and then it's, lolling around, floating down the stream on its back. And, I mean, it's just a bitch.
Uh-huh, Jan?
McKibben says amoral, uses the word amoral.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, you know, isn't it just a human judgment that there are moral and immoral actions in nature?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the ostrich is just as moral, that is, true to its being. See, that's one way to define define moral.
Yeah, he's not saying immoral. He's just saying amoral. Yeah, I think you're right, that category doesn't apply.
No.
She abandons her eggs, but look how she can laugh at the horse. I mean, and this, and even the category of wisdom. You know, God has made her forget wisdom, but God gave her those legs to run.
Mm-hmm.
She can't fly, but she flaps her wings.
And creatures are true to their being. I mean, in uh-huh. a way, it's a glorious departure or freedom from that very gift that we have that we find so distinctive, and that is our capacity to choose how we shall act. Most creatures act on instinct. I mean, creatures of higher intelligence may have some choice, but most of them act on instinct.
Uh-huh.
Even the laughter of the ostrich probably comes from, of course, it's a human rider describing this ostrich. I don't know. I just think there's something delightful in the author's ability to draw out the essence of each thing.
Uh-huh.
Celebrate that essence.
Mm. And that's what's going on here. Yeah, it really is. Uh-huh.
I think there's a real trust on the part of the ostrich. The ostrich leaves its egg on the earth to warm it, and it works. But there is the occasional accident where somebody will step on it.
It's like a turtle
burying
its eggs and
then
it swims away.
Yeah.
And then swimming
trust
away.
Nature to have them hatch.
Uh-huh.
It kind of reminds me of the little riff on the boat yesterday about the 14 bighorn sheep that have been released, and they have radio collars on them, and they can hear that they're out there, but nobody has seen them since they were released on the, what is it, on the north side of the lake?
Oh, really? I didn't know about that, huh?
Yeah.
And they're sitting in their dens laughing about how they got these radio collars.
But we'd love to see them, wouldn't we?
It's interesting that we're putting our human people interpretations on it, right? Because for the ostrich, we say, hey, it's dumb, leave it in there. But it works. And it works very well and has worked for eons and ostrich-like creatures for millennia. So we're looking at it from a very visual standpoint.
Mm-hmm. But I think the vastness is what he's trying to get at here, and the non-sort of human. What McKibben says is that it's almost as if, well, I think I mentioned this was chapter 38, it's almost as if God is singling out the wild creatures, the ones that haven't been tamed. There's no imagery in this poem, in these four chapters, of, you know, cattle and oxen that plow for us, of domesticated animals. It's particularly a speech about the wild animals. And in fact, I mean, in chapter 38, there was that reference to the water that falls on the land where no people dwell. In 39, verse 5, it's about the wild ass, not the domesticated ass. Who has loosed the bonds of the swift ass to give it the step for its home? It scorns the tumult of the city. It does not hear the shouts of the driver. I mean, it's almost as if the wild ones are the ones who are celebrated here, and that God is finding joy in, not the domesticated animals. And this sort of, you know, is the wild ox willing to serve you? Nope. Willing to spend the night at your crib? Nope. It's the wildness of nature.
Does McKibben say anything about, or would you, about verse 2 in chapter 38? Because it seems like that verse really nails us with God's view of us. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? And then the next sentence is equally challenging. Gird up your loins.
Uh-huh. Well, he doesn't say, let's see, he says the second great point of the whirlwind is the joy. The voice does not confine itself simply to you are small and I am large. It does not speak to us in purely rational terms, even though the discourse sort of starts like that. You know, get ready for a debate. You know, put your garments on, get ready for this debate, and I'm going to question you, and you can respond. he says it doesn't only call us to humility, though. I mean, I think that's certainly what's going on in this first part. It's set up as a kind of rational discourse, but it also calls us outside ourselves to this joy that's in the details of creation. But yeah, those are intriguing verses, those first ones, where it sounds like it's really going to be this kind of debate. No, I don't know that much about the Book of Job. I just like to read it. See, here you are. You've got a New Testament scholar doing stuff on the Old Testament, so I can use that as my excuse over and over. I don't do Old Testament except in Holden. Uh-huh.
Well, it seems like God is trying to bring him back as to one with nature. And it's like, why are you coming to me when the answers are in the earth I've created if you pay attention? Like, he's been caught up with all his good life, and he doesn't know, you know, how many months it takes for the dough to bear a fawn. You know, he doesn't know the simple answers for the creation because he hasn't observed closely.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and it's in the detailed observation. Now, McKibben does say, he points to Psalm 104. I guess we could look at that. I don't think we've got time. But that's a psalm that is similar in the sense of talking about the details of creation, that every animal has its own season, its own time. It's a beautiful psalm. You even need nighttime so that other animals can go to sleep, so that the lions can come and prey. I mean, it's such a observation of how nature works in this incredible harmony, and it's the details. The high lands are for the marmots and the rock badgers, and it's really there also, this sense of delight in creation. But that's a more, McKibben says, that's a more tender view of creation, in the sense of God's love for all these creatures. I mean, here it's almost this sense, at least to Job, hey, look, there's a whole world out there. It doesn't need you as part of it. Humans are really not the center of this whole wild, wonderful world. So my question is, does this really bring joy or not? Because, you know, it's kind of, I don't know, you're called outside yourself, but what you're called to is to realize that you're not big. Dan?
One other take on it, I think, is there's a whole body of literature about people who have found solace in nature. That is, it doesn't answer the why of the loss or the why of the grief. But people talk about simply by realizing their connection with other parts of nature, they found solace, they found some way to go on, they found that they are connected beyond themselves. So even though it feels like they've lost everything, they've lost their loved ones, they've lost their... And it seems like this is kind of the paradox here. God doesn't answer directly, why did this happen to me? But God does sort of point to a different kind of reality and says, there's another part here. And I'm just struck with the number of people who have written about great loss in their lives and the way they found healing. It didn't answer their question, but it did allow them to go on. And it was by being out in nature, seeing connection to things outside themselves.
Really?
So that, maybe okay. Another thing is going on here.
Yeah. And I, you know, because I've talked to a couple people, up, I guess, up here, even who talked about great loss in their lives. Well, how did you respond? I buried myself in my work. You know, that's one way to be called outside yourself, is just simply work. And it's important to keep going to work. But yeah, to go into nature, I think you're right. That's what's going on here, is that sense that nature can somehow cause you to forget your own troubles. And is that it, or?
Or at least bring some sense of solace. I guess the word solace is like you think of a perspective. I don't think it answers the questions, but it does, at least people talk right about it, allows them to get a different view and to move on.
Yeah, solace, I think, is somehow a better word than joy. He says here, McKibben says, the voice also calls us overwhelmingly to joy, to immersion in the fantastic beauty and drama all around us. It does not call us to think, to categorize, to analyze, to evaluate. It calls us to be. And he says, the reason Job matters so much to me is because of the language. The biologically accurate, earthy, juicy, crusty, wild, untamed poetry of God's great speech.
Uh-huh. Well, I think there's real joy when we don't feel like we're in charge of the universe. You know, I think the more you have, the more control and responsibility and boom. And I think to get our perspective that God's in charge, not us, gives us great freedom and joy. And I think that's part of the message here.
Uh-huh.
I think
there's
also, speaking to this, a serenity in nature that you do not feel when you're in the depths of grief. You know, it's outside of you and it surrounds you. And I think there's always a prayer for peace when you're feeling that way. But you can't find it within yourself. But when you're out in it and surrounded with it and looking.
Have you found it in nature?
That's what got me here.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
So that's how it speaks to me. That's what I can say.
And you're finding, as you look around here at the mountains and the river.
Serenity is always the word that I have attached.
Okay. Others? Did it bring you here, others?
It nurtures you.
Uh-huh. You had a hand up in the back. Let me say, he's got this funny passage at the end. He talks about, I mean, it's basically, I think, what you all have been talking about, the joy of immersing in something outside yourself. He says, I think this is the same pleasure that John Muir observed in Yosemite. John Muir is such a wonderful nature writer. He talks about, he's got this one quote that I love. I only went out to take a walk, but I ended up staying outside all day because going out, I found, is really going in. And he tended to, he writes about how he would lose himself in nature. I mean, he could spend a whole day up in a tree, just sort of swaying back and forth. He loved to do that. In a windstorm, it was even better because he swayed further. And he loved that. He says, I think this same pleasure that Muir observed in Yosemite, the joy of immersion in something outside yourself, something larger than yourself, I have felt that same kind of thing in the natural world. And he says that's the joy of Job, is to be called outside yourself to something much grander and bigger and awesome. Now, let me just read from the last section here, because this is where I don't think I would be able to say what he says. I'll just read this little anecdote. I stepped on a hornet's nest. I was stung at least 70 times, and it hurt like nothing I have ever felt. Alone, a half hour's hike from home, I was scared. I knew I was having some sort of reaction because hives were swelling up across my chest. I have a good imagination, so it was not much of a stretch to believe that I might not make it back home. And yet, the strongest feeling as I ran back down the ridge was a feeling of prayer, the simplest sort of prayer. Thank you, God, for these birds. Thank you, God, for these trees. Even, I think, thank you, God, for the hornets. Thank you that I am somehow linked to all of us, all of this. Never before had I felt so profoundly the rightness of the world around me. Perhaps it was my first experience as a potential link in the food chain. It was the least separated I had ever felt, the closest to being a creature. A trip to the hospital eventually erased my myriad bumps, but not that feeling of desperate at-homeness that I felt that afternoon on the ridge. He says, a planet filled with the vast order of creation. It is a buzzing, weird, abundant, reckless, haunting, painful, perfect planet. All of it matters. All of it is glorious. All of it can speak to us in the deepest and most satisfying ways, if only we will let it. I don't think I would have felt joy in the hornets, but that at-homeness, that desperate at-homeness really intrigues me that he talks about. Jan? Uh-huh.
I have to say that I don't think chapter 38, when it opens, I don't have my glasses, but, you know, we've been talking about how small it makes us feel. The effect for me is not to remind me that I'm but a mere speck in the universe. Instead, it goes on with all the language of measurements, of spans, of cornerstones, mm-hmm. and Psalm 104 is the same, the net, you know, the beams and so on. I think that these writers are talking about the interconnectedness they see. And the people who've talked about the solace or the serenity in nature, I too have experienced that. And I think that it comes from knowing that there is something like a net holding you up, that you are a part of this beauty. You are a part of this creation. Somehow that doesn't make me feel small and insignificant. It makes me feel significant in a new way.
Yes.
That is, even when I was grieving, when I was in pain, I could say, but I am a part of this because I'm a child of God. Mm-hmm. You know, God cares for me and the connection that I have with all of this, just as he cares for every other creature. And there's something very comforting in that. So uh-huh. I think that you know, the author of both Psalm 104 and Job might be talking about that realization.
Uh-huh.
And there's, to me, that is the most awe-inspiring thing in nature is to see how every single thing is connected.
It's not the connectedness mm-hmm. instead of aloneness.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that we're not alone.
Right.
Uh-huh. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Well, let me just summarize a little bit. We started the week by looking briefly at the Roman Catholic Bishop's pastoral letter on the Columbia River Basin, which is a draft document, not yet final, but it just came out this spring, talking about the whole watershed that extends from western Montana out to the ocean here. It includes British Columbia. And this question of how can we think together as a watershed about what to do about some of the crises in our landscape, the issue of the salmon, the trade-offs between salmons and dams, that obviously as humans we do tame nature and we need it for our livelihood, and how to adjudicate these competing claims. Wildness is part of it. How to have a sense of the history of the Pacific Northwest that fundamentally was a wild place, and whether there's intrinsic value to some of God's creatures. The document doesn't provide answers so much as it raises issues and tries to talk about the fragile parts of the ecosystem, including poor people and those who are in some ways most dependent on the land. How can a Christian view of a watershed encompass all this, and also this sense of the glory and wonder of creation? That document is in the library. There's one copy. You can also get it off the web. I'll put the web page address up when you go home. I think it's a really interesting, holistic approach to some of these questions that uses biblical texts. It doesn't use Job specifically, but it does use our theme verse from the summer, the Revelation 22 text about the tree of life. And the governing issue image is that of the water of life, the river of the water of life that flows through our lives, that flows through all the rivers of your lives, the ones that we've named that come into this watershed. I think this Job text is in some ways the most provocative, perhaps, of all we've looked at, because it is so different from the Yahwist vision of a cultivated world, you know, of the vocation of us as farmers. This is a text about wildness, pure and simple. At the end of his book, McKibben says the really scary thing is that these questions that are meant to be rhetorical in the book of Job, I mean, look back at chapter 38, these questions about weather, you know, are you able to make the weather change? Are you able to control the rain? The fact is that now, in a sense, we are. Suddenly, the answer to the rhetorical questions, I mean, each of these questions is supposed to be nope, nope. You know, are you able to do this or that? Nope, I'm not. Are you able to do this or that? Nope. But suddenly now, we are. We've altered the shape of the planet more in the last several generations than anyone ever thought possible. And the question is, what he ends with is, are we able still to hear the voice of God from the whirlwind? Or are we ourselves making the world a place where the voice of God is muffled, not drowned out altogether? The evidence of God will still be seen in the kindness of humans for each other, in self-sacrificing love. But too often this kind of evidence is left for moments of epiphany. He says we still need to see God as the one in charge of nature as well, and that some of what we've done to the world is muting or muffling these questions, which are meant to be rhetorical questions that have obvious no answers, but now, in fact, it's less clear. Let me just read one more quote. He says the key for us then is to hear the call of both these two perspectives here. Where is it? Sorry, I gotta find this one. The challenge before us is to figure out how to link these two callings, these two imperatives from the voice in the whirlwind. First, the call to humility, and second, the call to joy. And that we need each other as a community to do this, to overcome the orthodoxy of more that's as much an orthodoxy that won't work in our time as the orthodoxy of Job's time was, that good people have good things happen to them, bad people bad things, and that the voice of God from the whirlwind can really speak to us as a possible resource in how we respond to the ecological crisis. I think I have to let you go to coffee break. Thanks, everybody. Let the conversation continue at coffee break.
Thank you.